Hello and welcome to Irish Imperial Lives. I'm Kate O'Malley.
And I'm A.B. Philbin Bowman. And we've called today's episode Ireland's Forgotten Napoleon, inspired by a William Dalrymple quote about our subject today, who conquered more land in India and more quickly than Napoleon conquered in Europe. And yet he is almost completely forgotten today, in part because he has been eclipsed by his own ungrateful younger brother.
His name is Richard Wellesley, and he's the older brother of Arthur Wellesley, Duke of Wellington, the man who takes the lion's share of credit for defeating Napoleon at the Battle of Waterloo. And as we will learn today, many of the roads which led to that victory were paved by Richard.
For which his younger brother appears to have been singularly ungrateful. The other amazing thing about Richard Wellesley is that he has an almost exact counterpoint to Theobald Wolfe Tone. Both of them were born in a very similar era. They're about 3 years apart. They are both extremely ambitious, great speakers, very interested in the ladies.
Yes, but Aby, will we ever know just how much the ladies liked them?
Sadly, we won't. But the critical juncture in their lives seems to be that Richard Wellesley is sent to England to be educated, whereas Wolfe Tone remains in Ireland. And you fast forward to 1798, you have Wolfe Tone in a French military uniform trying to use French troops to get the British out of Ireland. Whereas on the other side of the world, in 1798, Richard Wellesley is landing in India with the specific mission of trying to suppress French influence and stop the French from cutting off that vital economic link to India, which is at this point fueling much of the British Empire's expansion. And the final counterpoint, of course, is today, when Wolfe Tone is this celebrated patriot with statues, squares, roads named after him, and Richard Wellesley is almost completely forgotten.
Yep, but forgotten no longer, because we're joined to talk about him today by historian and author Sheila McGuckian.
And we began by asking Sheila a question that has long hung around this family, which is, just how Irish are they?
You can trace their roots back to the 12th century. And they were what were considered the old Irish. They were settlers in the 12th century. And at some stage, many of the old Irish do become Protestant, and they did. I have heard a number of people saying he was ashamed of being Irish. I do not think that was the case. All through his life, he spoke about having been Irish, always wanted to be Lord Lieutenant. He always cared about Catholic emancipation. And as we'll see, it stopped him from becoming Prime Minister. Like, he literally had it within his hands. And he said, no, in 1812, we must bring in Catholic emancipation. He couldn't get enough people to back him on that. And it's funny, there were a number of very successful Irish politicians at that time. For example, Castlereagh, Canning, all of whom were friends. And in one letter, you actually see Castlereagh writing to Wellesley as "wee Paddies." So they viewed themselves as Irish.
Can you tell us about his parents? Because Richard himself dismissed them as frivolous and careless.
His father was a musician, seems to have been quite a talented musician, though none of his music has come down. He did actually become a professor of music at Trinity, so he was clearly quite talented. To talk about him as being poor sounds crazy because they lived in a castle, but they had no cash. And what money he did have, he didn't invest it, didn't build it up. In 1760, actually the year that Richard Wellesley was born, the family finally joined the peerage. Now it's the Irish peerage, which is very much regarded as secondary, but he does become an earl, the Earl of Mornington. And he married Anne. She was even less wealthy than he was. A respectable family, but no connections. But she really seems to have been the astonishingly ambitious person in the family. She had five sons and one daughter, Anne. And her husband died in 1781 when Richard was only 21 and the youngest son was still a child, and the others all had to go the whole way, even through school at this stage. But she was very, very ambitious. And it really seems that this Wellesley grit comes through her.
One of his biographers observed that Richard was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, though he would probably have preferred if it were gold.
Yes.
He's gold plate.
Catches
right?
Something.
Very much.
But it's funny because when his mother, I think she's 16 when she marries, One of the father's relatives goes, oh, you know, she's a bit of a silly girl. She's not very focused. But my God, does she get it quickly. She kind of bets the farm on sending these kids to school in England. Mm-hmm. And extraordinarily, I think it's Richard, starts in Harrow.
Yes.
And he's kicked out after a little over a year because he's taken to forward a role in, I think, a student protest about who's going to take over as headmaster of Harrow. And I have to say, if my son returned to me after I essentially mortgaged the family home to move to London at enormous expense to get him educated, and he gets himself kicked out of school. I would not be best pleased. And yet, from this, he moves to Eton, totally flourishes.
Yeah, at Eton, he just took off. He had no connections. And this is in the 18th century. All of the people of both the Tories and the Whigs who governed Britain at that time were all from the same families, all knew each other, all gave each other a leg up. He had no connection with those. And somehow he just makes this tremendous series of friends. The closest of whom is this chap called William Grenville, mm-hmm. who actually goes on to become Prime Minister in his own right, but who was closely related to William Pitt.
They were cousins, weren't they?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And William Pitt was the most powerful politician at that time. And he took Richard under his wing.
Oh, but I love the fact that that tenacity towards social engineering ultimately bore fruit, and boy, did it.
Oh, boy, yeah.
But he doesn't finish his education because his father dies, as you've alluded to.
That's right. He goes briefly to Oxford, but he doesn't finish. It's at that stage, at age 21, that he takes on responsibility for these four brothers. And it's quite surprising to realise how much William Pitt did support him. It wasn't purely altruistic, because actually Richard was very talented. He was a very good speaker. He had had some experience in the Irish House of Lords. Mm. And by the time he went to London, William Pitt was putting him forward for essentially rotten boroughs, where you could actually get somebody elected in a rotten borough. And in fact, one of those was the one for Windsor. And he annoyed the king, George III, so much, so they had to move him on somewhere else. But what he was an excellent speaker. And at that time, Pitt was with the Tories. But the Whigs on the other side had the brilliant speakers. They had Charles Fox, they had Brinsley. They had these tremendously good speakers. And there were much more limited speakers on the Tory side. So Wesley was sent out quite often. And in fact, he was the one who defended the declaration of war with France in 1793. Like, he was sent out for some big set pieces, and he was felt to be very useful for that.
And worth reminding people that in this period, the party structure that we have today is not nearly as well established. So being a good speaker who can convince these kind of independent-minded MPs is vital.
And he's also, don't forget, bringing his brothers behind
along
him.
Along with him, exactly. Yeah. They're very astute.
And a heavily mortgaged estate, which is not providing much money.
Which we should mention is Castle Dangan and Meath, correct?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
One of the fascinating details about this period is that he is so desperate to ingratiate himself, and a lot of his friends are advising him, look, there's a really smart strategic move you could make here, buddy, which is essentially marry well. Find a well-positioned lord with an eligible daughter or a sister you like, and then you will have a friend at court. You will have somebody to fight your corner who will want you to succeed. But he doesn't do that.
The bit that is really detrimental is he fell in love with a French woman. She had no connections. Her name was Hyacinthe Roland, and they lived together for 10 years and had five children together.
And was she Catholic, Sheila?
She was Catholic, okay. Yes. Not a terribly devout Catholic.
Perhaps on subjects like sex before marriage, not the most devout of Catholics.
No,
but the idea that they had five children before marriage is probably even a little unusual for that time. No?
Well, it was and it wasn't. But what Wellesley does that is difficult is he has five children with Hyacinthe, and then he marries her. And the issue with that is the children are never legitimated. So they couldn't inherit, they don't get titles. And then the other thing about having married Hyacinthe was there was no possibility of marrying anybody
again.
Else.
Hmm. Okay.
There's a description of him in this pre-India period where he is in his absolute element in Pitt's cabinet when he's debating policy with these great minds at the time, and he can hold his own and they can argue about political strategy and so on. He loves that. But he's absolutely terrible in social situations.
Yeah.
And similarly, when he's appointed to, I think it's the Board of Control for Indian Affairs, he throws himself into learning about Indian history and politics, and he finds that all fascinating. But he does not want to go to the board meetings, which are going to drag on and be tedious and full of admin and second-rate minds who he can't stand. And I think it really speaks to this person who's in certain circumstances just brilliant, and yet in other situations intolerant / intolerable.
100%. He's wonderful in a leadership role. And also these friendships that he makes, in fairness, last a lifetime. So the friends that he makes at Eton, the friends that he makes in India, stay friends forever.
So he's a loyal friend.
and they're loyal to him. Mm. He's trickier with women.
As you say, before he leaves, he is this slightly insecure guy, always looking for a job, always looking for preferment or the next title or where's the money coming from, trying to keep the brothers on some kind of pipeline or trajectory. And yet when he travels out to India, and he actually takes one of the brothers with him, I think it's Henry, as a confidant, and it's on that voyage that he starts to study India again and again, throw himself into learning the history and look at classical examples of leadership and so on. But he also, on the journey, gets to the Cape and meets a guy called Kirkpatrick, who has served a lifetime in India and is full of political intel and military insight into, look, this is where the troops are that you really need to worry about, and these are the leaders who are kind of potentially on our side, and gives him a brilliant overview. And by the time he lands in India, he seems to be ready to go with a plan.
I don't know that he's necessarily ready to go with a plan. I think he has a very good vision of how India is, because at this stage it is so fragmented.
Absolutely.
And it is through the agency of the East India Company that Britain is working. And it has only established itself in three places: Madras, which is now Chennai, Bombay, Mumbai now, and Calcutta and Bengal, which is where it's really established. This is a very large state, very wealthy state, where Britain has established a degree of control. And in fact, since 1757, has been collecting all of the taxes. Now then, in addition to that, there's a number of treaties with different independent states, because you have a huge number of very wealthy, very sophisticated Indian states, all of whom are competing with each other. And Britain is looking to sort of hold the balance of power and maybe increase a little bit. So when you said he had a plan, I think his plan, which was his instructions when he went over, were make sure French power is limited, because there's a real fear of Napoleon, but also to keep the balance of power in the states. And as he's there, as we'll see over the next 7 years that he's there, as the Indian states seek to make alliances, he steps in. But each one then has a domino effect on the other. Mm. So I think even he, at the end of his 7 years, would have been surprised at what had happened.
It seems from what I was reading, his plan, it to some extent, is this is my opportunity to prove myself.
Yes.
I'm far enough away from supervision. It takes long enough for the letters to come back that actually I've got a bit of a free hand here. And he's dealing in the confines. I think it was Pitt's India Act said only act in self-defence. And he'd been given the instruction from Dundas, just make sure the French don't dominate. And I think the way he sees it, if I can construe everything as a threat from France, I can kind of do what I like. But as you say, India is full of these various different powerful local rulers, all in competition with each other. And one of the early ones he really has to deal with is Hyderabad, which is kind of almost the cornerstone of the southern part of India. And the problem there is that the local ruler, the Nizam, is got an awful lot of French mercenaries and commanders in his army. And Wellesley's sort of first move is to basically persuade him, look, if things go wrong and the French ally with Tipu Sultan to your south, then the French could suddenly convince all these French mercenaries to have a mutiny among your forces. And then you're gone and you're off the throne, but I can be a really useful friend to you. So it's all the time trying to play the various forces off against each other. And he manages through diplomacy to get the Nizam to disarm his French mercenaries. And that's a pivotal moment, because now he's got Hyderabad locked away and he can turn his attention to Tipu Sultan in the south and know that he isn't going to face a war on two fronts.
Yeah, that's right. Mysore is this country. It's to the southwest of the Nizam's territories. Very big, very powerful. Two superbly talented leaders, Hyder Ali and his son Tipu Sultan. And Britain had been involved in three wars already with Mysore at that stage. The first war, Mysore had bested the East India Company troops. The second war was one where, just as you've described, Mysore and the Nizam's territories were rubbing up against each other, and they had come in to back the Nizam. And that had ended up in a quite unsatisfactory treaty. The final Mysore War, which was about 10 years before, the British had sent General Cornwallis, one of their great generals, down, and he had had a full war. This time he was leading the action and he was followed by the Nizam at this stage. And this had succeeded extraordinarily well. It resulted in Mysore losing a lot of its territory. But Tipu Sultan, who was in charge at that time, was enraged about this. And so when he saw France having its revolutionary wars, he had actually written to Napoleon. I don't know if Napoleon ever even got the letter, but he wrote to other French officers saying, now's our chance. You join up with me and we can throw the British out of India. And in fact, when these letters landed...
Yes, did Wellesley hear about these letters?
Of course he did. He couldn't believe his luck.
Yeah, here is all the evidence you need to say, look, the French and Tipu are arm in arm. They're about to attack us. I've got to get Tipu first. Give me all the money I need and all the troops I need to go and
also,
take Tipu out.
Tut, tut, Tipu. What would
Bold
you expect?
Tipu. Absolutely. And to the extent that literally for about a decade afterwards, people thought they must have been forgeries.
Napoleon did apparently have intentions and obviously the Battle of the Nile stopped him in his tracks.
Well, to bring Ireland in here, I mean, this is a moment when Ireland is desperately looking to Napoleon going, please, please send troops to Ireland. And we've got 1796, which almost happens, and we've 1798, where not enough troops land. Because by this point, Napoleon's turned to Egypt and potentially through Egypt, if he can cut off the massive source of income you've alluded to in Bengal, if the British lose Bengal, that is a huge proportion of their imperial empire underfunded suddenly. So the danger is real.
Yes, but the thing you have to remember about Tipu Sultan is he is a really intelligent man and a really excellent leader of his military. He does a couple of things. He uses the weather and the seasons in order to entice armies out and then get them caught in the monsoon or get them caught in periods where there's no food. So one of the things that Wellesley, you're absolutely right, he has to work with Hyderabad in order to make sure that that's in place. But he's still working against the weather. And Wellesley gets accused of not negotiating in seriousness. Neither of them were. Tipu Sultan was kind of trying to buy time, saying, wait a minute, right, now you can come, knowing that they can come and land in the monsoon. So there is this element of time. And this is what's amazing is that this 38-year-old Irish man, you know, having rocked up in India 18 months before, is aware of this. And one of the ironies of the East India Company is it's actually something of a meritocracy in the 18th century because nobody goes who doesn't have to go. So it's impoverished younger sons, like Arthur. It's lots of very talented and ambitious Scots and a lot of Anglo-Irish going. And so Wellesley does have terrific generals. But yes, he strikes and it's a total success. There's this massive city of Seringapatam, which is beautiful and full of treasures and high on a mountaintop. And previous armies had never been able to get near it. But on this case, there's a siege, it's taken, and Tipu Sultan dies fighting. And actually, he is now regarded as a national hero.
Oh, very much so. He is really considered a hero. And the manner of the pillage and looting afterwards has been really significant in contemporary Indian culture. Wellesley would have been responsible for a fair amount of nasty propaganda in advance about him. Mm-hmm. And then when he was found dead and the funeral in the days afterwards, they realised that, you know, we're dealing with a very sophisticated ruler who was loved and who was very much missed.
Tipu is really the last Indian leader who could have kept the British at bay, essentially. But once he's out of the picture, there is then the Marathas, who, had they worked together and had they united, could actually have posed a really serious threat. But again, Wellesley's very good at playing divide and conquer, almost as if he'd learned from his own brothers how to play off family members against each other.
Well, just before he gets to the Marathas, 1799, there are two very large important states, one down on the east coast, which is the Carnatic. And the reason that it was important, it bordered onto Madras, which was the British East India Company outpost. And although the Nawab of the Carnatic was an ally, he was doing a very, very bad job. And then the Nawab dies and he leaves a 13-year-old heir, which doesn't suit anybody. And so Wellesley is able to work with the locals to pick a nephew who was an adult who takes over. He's put on as a puppet. And then there's one other very large province, and that's right up in the north, butting onto the edge of Bengal. And that's the province of Oude. Same situation, an ally there who had been a supporter of the British, but again, doing a really bad job, really unpopular. The state is in rag order. And in that case, it is not in any way consensual. Wellesley is really bullying and very, very threatening of the Nawab there and eventually succeeds in getting a treaty, bringing fully British troops into Oude and also forcing the Nawab to cede territory.
Do tell us finally about the Marathas.
So the Marathas, you've got these three very, very able leaders, but they really personally did not like each other and were also constantly looking at each other's territories. So from the period 1802 to 1804, you have a series of wars fought with different of the Maratha leaders. allying themselves, sometimes with each other, sometimes with the British. Like, it's a real divide and conquer situation. And there's some very serious battles. Wellington's first great battle. He's become a general at this stage, and it's the Battle of Assaye. And he has a much smaller force. He takes on this enormous Maratha force and defeats it, really surprising people, because the Marathas were very, very warlike. And after 2 years, eventually the Marathas look to settle. Now, they don't lose all their territory. That takes another 20 years. But at the end of the Maratha War, Britain has extended even further in the north. It's now got Delhi, in which the old, blind,
yeah, very
sad
symbolic, yeah,
Mughal emperor is sitting there. Yes, absolutely. It's got Agra. Almost as significantly, it is given the state of Cuttack. And with that in place, Britain has control over the entire eastern seaboard of India.
Oh, I'd really encourage our listeners to look at a map before and after Wellesley, just to see
it's
the vast swathes of territory that he accrued. Yeah. I mean, we can't really overstate the significance of his tenure in India, because after it, Britain has dominance over the subcontinent.
100%.
It really is the nail in the coffin of Mughal rule.
We should say, in the process of doing all this, he nearly bankrupts the East India Company.
Oh, that's it.
I mean, the directors are not happy. They're going, who is this guy running amok? And yet he's going, look at all that I have conquered.
Yes, it was actually worse than that. He was fired. The directors of the East India Company fired him. Now, he knew it was coming because they'd been sending him. I was like, what are you doing? This is costing us a fortune. Nobody asked you to do this. So he resigned. But his resignation crossed with the letter firing him. So he arrives back having conquered a virtual subcontinent, and he'd been fired.
So he comes back then to London, and again, the love life is very active. His own brother, Arthur Wellesley, says, I wish Wellesley was castrated.
He seemed to have a penchant for actresses, am I right?
Yeah.
So he came back and his marriage broke up very acrimoniously. And he really had a nervous breakdown.
He was burnt out from India, presumably.
He
in
was.
Today's parlance.
And you're right, he did have a number of affairs with actresses, and actually some officially designating themselves as courtesans. He arrives back in 1805, and his very good friend, if you remember right back the way to Eton, William Grenville, had just become Prime Minister.
Handy.
Do you like to join my cabinet? And actually Wells goes, no, I'm just too exhausted and I can't. A couple of years later, his other very good friend, Lord Portland, becomes Prime Minister in 1807, and again says, would you like to join my cabinet? And I said, no, I'm just can't. But my two brothers, Arthur, and
still looking out for the
William, William would love to join. So both of them were to become Chief Secretary of Ireland.
I mean, this is not the end of his story, because he does become then ambassador to Spain.
He goes out to Spain, and Spain is in a terrible situation. It has been invaded by Napoleon, but a lot of the Spanish have pulled back and are still continuing to fight. And so Wellesley, as the British representative, is somebody who has an awful lot of influence, and he has a plan for Spain that he can work with the Spanish guerrillas and the Portuguese who are fighting the French, and who should be the chief of that army. And Richard's like, well, my brother is a very talented soldier and I'm going to back him. Arthur at this stage has become a general, has fought in a number of battles even before this and has become highly regarded. And it is quite funny, Napoleon always referred to him as a sepoy general in a dismissive manner.
Oh.
But of course, his tremendous fights against the very able Indians had actually set him up as
what a training ground.
Terrifically good general, yes. And then, towards the end of that year, Wellesley gets appointed Foreign Secretary. So he goes back to London and he spends an enormous amount of his time and prestige and everything as Foreign Secretary supporting his brother Arthur's campaign in Spain. And the thing about it is, certainly in the beginning, it's very slow. It takes an awful lot of troops. It takes a lot of money. At one stage, they want to take 300,000 Portuguese troops into the British forces. And that's going to cost a fortune. But Wellesley pushes it through. The Whigs are very much opposed to this policy, and it's costing too much money, we should settle.
And just in case you thought the story couldn't get more dramatic, the Prime Minister is assassinated and Wellesley's offered the job.
Poor old Spencer Percival was assassinated, and the Prince Regent gets in touch with Wellesley and says, you know, do you think you can cobble together a government? And Wellesley, with his dear old friend George Canning, says, let's see what he can do. Now, in his period as foreign secretary, he'd fought with everybody because, you know, he'd been supporting his brother. He was never terribly good at working people. He was grumpy. But he does seem to have got Earl Grey, who was very much regarded as a Whig. He had a number of these people who had said, yes, OK, we'll come in, we'll take you as our leader. And then at the very end, the last straw is he and George Canning, who was always very much in favour of Catholic emancipation, say, look, Catholic emancipation has to be part of the policy. And it falls. And it may well be that that was an excuse for the people who didn't want to work with him, having thought about it. And just as it falls, the Prince Regent's like, what are we going to do? Who are we going to find? And he turns to Lord Liverpool, another person who was at Eton with Wellesley, and Liverpool cobbles together a coalition. Nobody thinks it's going to last. And Wellesley resigns. And the next thing, out of the blue, Wellington starts to get these massive victories. And at the same time, we see Napoleon overreached in
Russia.
And you see the whole Napoleonic War from what had seemed 3 years ago impossible. It just turns, and it turns that autumn as he huffs off. It's literally victory after victory, a lot of them at the hands of Wellington, certainly as far as the British were concerned. And with each victory, it strengthens Lord Liverpool's government.
So had he stayed in for a little bit longer, if he might have reaped the benefit of that policy.
If he'd even stayed, yeah.
Because we have limited time, I always want to get to the period when he's appointed Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, we should say.
He arrived into Dublin and he just picked a fight with the Protestant ascendancy, and in particular with the very conservative Protestant
Orange lodges
and parties that were massively influential at that stage. And people were afraid of them. I mean, the British didn't particularly like them. They weren't the world's most lovable people. They were aggressive. They were holding down the Catholics, but they were loyal. And so the British government were prepared to put up with pretty unpleasant behaviour.
How times change.
Yes.
This is the era of Daniel O'Connell campaigning for Catholic emancipation. You would think they'd be sort of natural allies on that issue. What is the relationship like in practice? Can these two egos bear each other?
Well, no. On this, Wellesley is a moderate. He does want Catholic emancipation, but it's going to take a while. His government has said, we're not going to do it yet. And in the meantime, he's to bring forward Catholics to give them the rights that they have, which are pretty much all the rights except being a member of Parliament. And it's not enough for O'Connell. O'Connell is fed up. You know, it's been years of manana, manana, and he's like, nope, I've had enough. He sets up the Catholic Association, and then absolutely brilliantly, the following year, he comes up with this idea of a Catholic rent, which is that every Catholic should pay a penny to the organisation. And that has raises money, but much more importantly, it means that the organisation gets the names of everybody. It means people feel they have ownership in it. By 1825, O'Connell has the vast, vast majority. So Wellesley is kind of saying, slow down. Now, he is very much trying to promote it, but he's not able to grant it immediately.
So politically, he understands it's necessary. But I'm wondering, is there a personal aspect to that, given his first marriage?
And his second marriage to an American Catholic.
Well, that's right. That's the other thing he does. He marries an American Catholic widow, and the king goes mad because he said there's a Catholic ceremony in his castle. And in fact, the other person who goes mad is the Duke of Wellington, because she had been the love of his life, but he couldn't marry her because his brother's girl.
Sorry, can we rewind there? Tell us the story of the brothers and the girl.
So the brothers, first of all, were in India together. He had been constantly lobbying for all of his brothers.
Yes, and when he's foreign secretary, he is what keeps Wellington in the peninsula. And the peninsula is what makes Wellington Wellington, basically. And at the end of it, just seems to no good deed goes unpunished. Wellington just turns on Wellesley. Unlike Wellesley, he doesn't seem to have any sort of inferiority complex, but he nearly doesn't want to give Wellesley any credit for what he's done. And so throughout those 10 years, when Wellington is one of the great men in Britain and Wellesley's having his nervous breakdown, so sort of, you know, 1812 to about 1820, and even during his Lord Lieutenancy, Wellington spends his entire life being mean to him. He tries to get Liverpool to fire him 3 times. He writes mean things about him.
Wow.
One of his biographers, Severn, who's tremendously in favour of Wellington, says, like, it's just hard to understand how much he resents his older brother. And the older brother never did anything against him except
well, effectively
help him.
He made him.
Oh, completely. To be honest, Wellesley isn't quite as aware of this, just how much Wellington resents him. But Wellington had a very unhappy marriage and he had many love affairs, but he fell in love with this woman called Mary Ann Caton Patterson, who was a Catholic from America. Most people reckon that that was a serious, serious love affair. And initially, she was married and he was married and she went back to America. Her husband died and she came back. back. And Wellington's like, she's back. But he was still married. And in 1824, she tootled off to visit his brother, who was Lord Lieutenant. So all of that grandeur in Dublin Castle clearly worked, because she fell in love with Richard and married Richard. And Wellington just couldn't believe it.
Thank you, Sheila. Absolutely wonderful whistle-stop tour through his life.
Thank you.
And Sheila McGuckian's forthcoming book is entitled Worse Than War, Anglesey in Ireland, 1828 to 1833.
Also thanks to all of those who are responsible for helping us get the series on the air: Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Nigel Wheatley and Sally Curran. And also our theme music is from composer Bill Whelan's Belfast Linen and Lace.
You can listen back to this episode or any of our previous ones on the RTE website or wherever you podcast. Just search Irish Imperial Lives. Thanks.